Born in the grip of oppression, I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. But when I'm attacked, I protect and defend. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free.
Hello everyone, hope you had a wonderful week and enjoyed Thanksgiving and spent some time with family and friends and had a wonderful, wonderful week, because we have lots of challenges in front of us, but that's not what this is going to be about today. Today, we have to take a deep look at really what's going on in this country, because everybody thinks that what's happening today is brand new, never happened before, never had these situations before, and that is absolutely not true. I just read an article, very sad, and I do want to make a comment on the people that went to the parade in Wisconsin. That was so sad, and our hearts go out, and we grant you our greatest sympathy. It is so sad to watch this happen. And just like it is sad to see on the other side what's going on with our cities. The other day, there was a major incident in Walnut Creek, California at Nordstrom's when 50 people stormed into the business and robbed everything in sight. And yet we are being told this has never happened before. America is crossing into new territory. I beg to differ. This has been going on for centuries, and nobody is better to describe what we are experiencing than my friend Bill Federer, who is an author, a journalist, and writes the most incredible emails. You must go to his website, which is AmericanMinute.com. You must put your email address in and get his emails every day. What an eye-opener. Thank you so much for joining me today, Bill. This is Karen Schoen, and you're listening to the Prism of America's Education. Bill, thank you. And when I read your latest email, I said, my goodness, this is a real reminder of how deep this right-left communism, capitalism has worked over the years. Nothing has changed. Nothing is different. And then I get your email and you affirm the fact that nothing has changed and nothing is different. So, Bill, maybe you can explain to our audience why our kids being fed that America is a racist country from its inception is absolutely wrong.
Yeah, well, it's a communist tactic called deconstruction, where you separate people from their past, get them into a neutral where they don't remember where they came from, and then you brainwash them into the future. You have planned for them. It's a sales technique. So if I was a toothpaste salesman, the first thing I do is tell you negative things about the toothpaste you're currently using. You're still brushing with that old stuff. Haven't you heard it's terrible? It'll eat the enamel off your teeth. Ooh, you're repulsed by it. Now I have you in a neutral position. You're open-minded. What are all the new toothpaste out there? Then I give you my pitch for this brand new tartar-controlled breath freshener toothpaste. So that's what they do. They go into the classrooms and they tell the kids negative things about the founding fathers. They took land from Indians. They sold people into slavery. They were chauvinists. They were terrible. And ooh, the kids are repulsed by them. Now you got the kids in a neutral. They're open-minded. What are all the belief systems out there? Then you give them your pitch for socialism or LGBT or Sharia Islam. And this isn't the first time this has occurred. The French Revolution did this. Right. So they had 1,000 years of Catholic cathedrals, Protestant Reformation, and Jewish neighborhoods. But then the French Revolution comes along and says, we want to erase all that. And they made 1792 the new year one. They decided they didn't want a 7-day week because it went back to the Bible. And so they came up with a 10-day week called a decade week. And they made a decade week because 10 days, right? So they made every measurement in France divisible by 10. They said 10 was the number of man because you count with 10 fingers. And so they called it the metric system. But they tore down statues of good King Henry IV, who in the 1500s tried to patch up Protestants and Catholics. They dug up the grave of Saint Genevieve, who during the 5th century helped get Paris to fast and pray, and Attila skipped sacking Paris, Attila the Hun. And so, but during the French Revolution, they dug up her bones and trashed them. And you think, why is this? Well, you have to get rid of the past and get the people into this neutral where they don't have a memory where they came from. Then you brainwash them to the future you have planned for. Sharia Muslim jihadis do this. They come into an area. When they came into Egypt, they destroyed the pyramids. They destroyed all the different temples and so forth. When they went into Greece, they destroyed all that. And they rename everything with Muslim names. Right. All Turkey used to be the Byzantine Christian Empire, and all that was wiped out. When they went into areas of northern India, they wiped out all their Hindu traditions and so forth. And so this idea of the conquering country wipes out the language, the history, the culture of the previous culture, or considering it inferior to their new perfect and so forth. And so what they're doing in the classrooms is called deconstruction. It's a literal strategy. When you, I talked to somebody that had been in Russia and in Latvia, and he said that when the Soviets controlled Latvia, they wrote in the history books that the Latvians were all tribal cavemen before the Russians came and civilized them. And it's like, no, the Latvians had a rich history of their own that went back centuries and centuries. And but the this concept is being used throughout history. China, 3rd century BC, it's called the Warring States period, half dozen kingdoms fighting. One wins, led by Qin Shi Huangdi. And he began to do things differently than they had been done before. And he was criticized for doing things differently. And he decided he would destroy all records of how things were done before. And he destroyed tens of thousands of bamboo annal books and just burnt them. All the classics of history were burnt. Had the classics of Chinese history not been buried in the tomb of a previous emperor, they would have not existed. But luckily, some of them were buried with this previous emperor. But Qin Shi Huangdi just wanted to destroy history. So Mao Zedong in the 1960s copied this. And he wanted to bring in communism, so he destroyed as much Chinese heritage as he could get his hands on. He destroyed the oldest Buddhist temple in China. He destroyed the Great Gates of Beijing. They would bring out people that were trained in Western sciences and literature, and doctors, lawyers, teachers, and they would bring them in and white shame them and get them to confess that they were infected with the evils of the Western society. And they would cut them on the head and they would bleed. And the more blood these kids got on their clothes, the more they were considered new youth, you know, like the Hitler youth. And so Pol Pot did the same thing in Cambodia. He made 1975 the New Year Zero, said anything prior to that was irrelevant. And he killed anybody that wore glasses.
Oh my
he
goodness.
Said, if you wore glasses, you could read. If you read, you knew the history, you want to get rid of the history. So whenever you have someone coming in wanting to rewrite the history, it's because they want to set up a totalitarian government and they have to erase everything in the past. In America, we have what's called Western Judeo-Christian heritage, which emphasizes the value of the individual. Every other culture, they don't care about individuals. They care about groups. And the group is controlled by an influencer, a king, a pharaoh, a Caesar, a deep state political establishment. But Judeo-Christian culture highlights the individual.
Can I ask you a question? It doesn't matter then from what you're saying that even when you're talking about Western countries, they are more concerned with the collective than they are with the individual?
Yeah. So
America is really the only country that focuses on the individual.
Yeah, that's the origin. Goes back to ancient Israel when they come out of Egypt around 1400 BC. For 400 years, Israel did not have a king. And every single individual was taught the law. And you were individually accountable to God to follow the law. So that's how they could maintain order. So if you wouldn't steal because there weren't any police around, but the reason you didn't steal is because you believed God was watching you and he was going to hold you accountable in the future.
So if I can, the idea that, as you said, God is watching you and will hold you accountable in the future they have no God, so therefore it doesn't make any difference. They are the creators then of what they expect their future to be.
Right. Well, there's a verse in the Bible where it says, you know, Lucifer said, I will be like the Most High. And so we see that they're wanting to replace this consciousness of, hey, God's watching me, with the state's watching me. And so in China, they have all the social credit system. They have cameras everywhere. They have apps that track you everywhere. They track all your purchases, all your Google views, all your, you know, places that you frequent. And everybody's walking around saying, oh, I'm being watched by the government. They've replaced the concept of I'm being watched by God, wants me to be fair and do unto others as I would have them do unto me. You replace that with I'm being watched by the government, and the government wants me to not express my personal thoughts, wants me to do everything in their agenda. And so we're seeing that being implemented in America. It's called the spiral of silence, where people will self-censor their personal views if they feel like they're in the minority. And so they want to control the internet and all these different things. So people feel like, gee, I'm in the minority. I'm going to silence my views. And
what is that called again?
Called the spiral of silence.
Spiral of silence.
They did a wine tasting experiment where everybody was in on it except one naive couple. And they poured vinegar in the wine. And this couple tastes it and writes onto their little card, this tastes terrible. But they go around the room and all these other couples stand up and they say, this was great. It was robust. It had depth. It had character. They finally got around to this naive couple. They scratched out what they wrote and they stood up and said, yeah, it was good.
Oh,
they denied their own personal views because they wanted to fit in with the group. And then when somebody pointed out that all they did was pour vinegar in the wine, the couple that had changed their views criticized the person for saying they poured vinegar in. And so it's something called false enforcement. Once somebody buys into the lie, they will help enforce that other people have to buy into the lie and submit to it, right? It's like, you know, once they think, oh, you got to wear masks, they want to pull out their camera and take a picture. Everybody else is not wearing a mask, right? They don't know the science behind, you know, how small the virus is and how large the holes are in the mask. They don't know anything about that. They just are part of enforcing something that they see that they finally bought into. So it's called psychological operations. And this was really studied during the Cold War. And we used these tactics, CIA and the KGB, to take over countries, to keep them from siding with the Soviet Union. And then they did it opposite, to take countries and make them side toward the Soviet Union. But now we see these tactics being used on our own soil. But the goal is to get you to psychologically feel depressed, discouraged, and give up your freedoms.
So what they are intending to do, or what they are doing, is try to get the entire group of people into a cognitive dissonance where they can see the truth but can't express it for fear of being an outsider.
Yeah, it is been studied initially through marketing. So how do you influence people to want to buy your product? So in the 1800s, it was Wells Fargo Wagon, Sears catalog, and you would list every detail about a sewing machine. But then in the early 1900s is the invention of magazines with slick ads, and they would make it look like everybody's using a product. And they found out that people would buy the product, not because they know anything about it, just because they see everybody else using it. And the classic is Crisco. Nobody knew what was in it. They actually created a fake term called vegetable based. And, but they had these ads of happy families eating delicious looking food. And so it put out of business the lard industry. They used to render lard from animal fat and make soap and so forth out of it. Do you know what's in Crisco? Most people don't.
Chemicals.
It's cottonseed oil.
Oh.
Right. So in the deep South, they'd harvest cotton. They had mountains of black seeds that they'd mushed together into this gucky oil they'd use in machinery and factories. Nobody ate that stuff, but somebody came up with the idea of boiling it and putting it in these packages and have nice slick magazine ads. And so you go from knowing everything about a product convinces you to buy it to now you know nothing about a product, but it looks like everybody else is using it. And so it's called keeping up with the Joneses. And it's this manipulation of your perception of what everybody likes. So ladies will read a fashion magazine. Why? Because they want to see what is in, what's everybody else wearing. And then they want to copy that. And, but then we add in fear. So Orson Welles' 1938 radio drama, War of the Worlds. We interrupt this program to announce that New Jersey is being invaded by Martians. The whole entire country immediately freaks out, runs outside, looks in the sky for spaceships. It was a phenomenon of fear that electrically went across the country and motivated people. And this was studied, and they had all kinds of psychological thriller movies. You know, one was called Gaslight, where Ingrid Bergman, the actress, had a aunt who was a had a famous career as an actress in England in this movie, and was given some expensive jewels, but she died and all of her stuff is locked in the attic, and it's too emotional for Ingrid to dig through the attic. And but some guy wants the jewels, so he courts Ingrid Bergman, marries her, and but in the evening he is going to go for a walk and smoke his pipe, and but he goes out and down the street, climbs up the escape ladder onto this building in London, and goes across the roofs and climbs in through the roof. And when he turns the gas lamp on in the attic to dig around looking for jewels, the gas lamp in Ingrid Bergman's bedroom gets dimmer. And she tells him, you know, whenever you go for your walk, the light in my room gets dimmer. And he said, oh, your eyes are playing tricks on you. You're seeing things. I think you're going crazy. The stress is getting to you. We're going to need to take you to a psychiatrist. Maybe we need you to commit you to an insane asylum. And he's about to sign her away when the hero of the movie, you know, follows him down the street and sees the gas go on in the attic and gets dimmer in her bedroom. And so the movie's called Gaslight, but it's taken to a cultural national level where you want to manipulate the perception of everybody in the country. And Joseph Goebbels studied this during the Nazi. He was the minister of propaganda, where he'd orchestrate 100,000 people in a coliseum, and then they would begin to give the Hitler salute. And with the fear of the war and everybody else seeing everybody else giving the Hitler salute, they would feel pressure to give the Hitler salute. And then that people would see you giving it and they would feel pressure. And so it's how you manipulate the perception of what the group is doing. And it's an entire study. And there's more to it. I don't know if you want me to talk about it.
Well, yes, I do. But this now is directly related to the quote insurrection, which they are trying to get everyone to believe happened on 1/6, when in reality, that was not an insurrection at all. And they ignore what really went on with all of the riots that we had in that entire summer. So this is an example of what you have just been describing, is it not?
Yeah, it's called basically the evidence points to it being an entrapment program done by the FBI. What's entrapment or sting operation? So it used to be they try to catch the criminal gang in the act. And then they would have somebody infiltrate the gang and, you know, track them and then catch them in the act. And then they'd have somebody infiltrate the gang and actually plan the attack. And then the gang would be sucked into it and they would be caught till finally, for example, this kidnapping plot of Governor Whitmer in Minnesota, like 12 people were in on it. Six of them were FBI agents and they were planning everything, organizing everything, paying for everything. And then they got a half dozen low IQ people that they would call up and say, we need you to show up here. And they're like, oh, okay. And then they said, we caught this plot. Well, they're the ones that planned the whole thing. Right. And so the evidence points to, with the security cameras that have leaked, that here you have the police inviting people into the Capitol, and people that were there said that it was cold that day. They thought they were being let in out of the cold. Somebody thought they were getting a free tour of the Capitol, right? You know, I mean, yeah. And then all of a sudden you see a window with like a dozen guys dressed in complete black with tactical gear busting in and running to do stuff that they looked like it was organized. It does not look like this was a group of people that heard a Trump speech and got riled up and wanted to break into the Capitol. It clearly looks like this was some kind of planned event for the purpose of optics. What's that? That's where you want to have something with pictures that they can play over and over again to convince the people of a particular storyline that they want to push. So instead of having a million supporters of Trump, and he's the most popular president in American history, you know, unless you believe that the guy in the basement with dementia was more popular, I was in Vermont for a week, and there was a sweet little lady, 80 years old. She and her husband had organized a bus of Vermonters to go and support President Trump. And she got a call on her voicemail. Hi, I'm with the, select committee of, the Congress, and we want to talk to you about the January 6th attack. And it's like, here's an 80-year-old lady, and they're wanting to investigate her about an attack. Look, there were no weapons used in this January 6th event. The only killing was the police kill. The most protected building on planet Earth is the U.S. Capitol. There are 2,300 Capitol police officers. Nobody gets into that building unless they want you in that building. And so anyway, and I do have a question, for Pence. I have a degree in accounting, and I remember a story of a partner in a big company that certified, which the word means to make certain, financial statements. And there was an inventory of one subsidiary company that was listed higher than the inventory should have been in natural gas. And the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, did an investigation and found out, sure enough, he had accepted the numbers from this subsidiary company, and he did not audit them. And so the partner had to go down to the police department and book himself in. Because when you're an accounting partner and you certify statements, you're personally guaranteeing to the investing public that these numbers are trustworthy. You don't just accept numbers. And if there was legal counsel from the subsidiary companies saying, hello, we have some questions about this, you certainly would not certify it. If there was 27 attorney generals from the state saying, you need to look into this, you don't just rush it through. And I think even Louis Gohmert brought a lawsuit saying, look, he does have the authority to question this. And he had the Department of Justice counter it, saying, no, I don't want to have the authority. It's like something fishy is going on.
It's very fishy.
And I think it needs to be looked into.
I agree with you, because these are new things that we're learning. How do you have an insurrection or an attack if nobody has a weapon? What are they going to do? Hit you with your phone? I mean, that was insane to even think.
Well, even Tucker Carlson showed pictures of somebody on the street the night before saying, we need to break into the Capitol. It's like a dozen people had videotaped this guy. And all evidence, and what Tucker was pointing out, was this guy was one of the FBI plants, and he was there in the crowd. This is the night before. This is before Trump's speech. Okay. Before Trump even says a speech, they're on the street saying, we need to break into the Capitol. It's like, again, it does not look like these were people that heard some speech and they got riled up and they broke in. It looks like this was an entrapment program or a sting operation that was something planned.
Okay, and these types of maneuvers and these types of things are what we're going to be continually seeing, because that's the way communism works. They will make up anything and use it as so-called evidence from an anonymous source, and then go after the people like they're doing now and put them in a prison that is unbelievably disgusting and horrifying to even think that it's part of the American prison system. I can't even imagine that people are so cruel that they would intentionally do this. But then that goes back to what you said, Bill. They have been totally brainwashed into thinking that these people who they have arrested are the enemy.
Yeah, the whole entrapment thing is, they say if you go to a third world country in South America and you get stopped by the authorities, keep your window rolled up, because they could lean in the car and drop some drugs in. And then they want to have you get out of the car and search it. And then they claim to find the drugs, and then they arrest you. And, so it's once you get rid of God, I tell people, would somebody really do things to steal elections? I said, look, they have in their party platform killing innocent babies. Is there anything that, if you can justify that, is there anything you can't justify?
No, you're right. That's why I now call Joe Baby Killer Joe, because that's what this bill is all about. There is no difference between killing a baby the day before it's born or the day after it's born. What's the difference? A baby is still the baby. And the fact that they are willing and encouraging a late term abortion is just as horrible as you can imagine with anything else. But you're right, Bill, they have no God. Where does Allah fit in all of this? He condones killing of babies?
Well, the founding fathers, by and large, had the God of the Bible as their God. And why is that significant? The word equality. So the God of the Bible says that you treat everyone the same, that male and female, everyone is made in the image of the Creator, that rich and poor, there's no respect of persons in judgment. And the God of Sharia Islam says that Allah loves the Muslim who has submitted. The word Islam means submission. And Allah does not love the person that rejects Allah. It does, right? So the Bible says it's the love of God that brings men to repentance, that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. So the God of the Bible loves you even when you're a sinner. And it's his overwhelming love that and his forgiveness that causes people to say, gee, I've been so terrible and he loves me. I'm going to submit myself to this God. It's a voluntary thing. But the God of Islam only loves those who have submitted. So, and if you refuse to submit, he hates you. So that's quite an important difference.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
And there's a verse in the Quran that says, Allah loveth not those who have rejected the faith.
Okay. And I also saw that you even wrote that there was a hadith that said that they are supposed to destroy all of the old artifacts. What we have copied, it seems as though we have copied a lot from the Islamic religion. And that was a great cause of what's happening today. I took a picture, folks, and I took the picture of the women in Iran wearing their burqas, covered their faces, covered their mouths, covered everything about them. And all you could see on these poor women were the slits of their eyes. And yet, way back, Iran was a very westernized country. So this was a new thing. But why? And then you take a look at the American people wearing masks, and they remind me of exactly the same thing. I don't see a difference. Once you're hiding a person's face, you're taking away their identity. And isn't that what Islam does?
Yeah, it does have a second-class status for women. There's a verse where it takes two women to testify in court against one man because Muhammad said a woman's mind is deficient. A man can have four wives in Islam. A woman cannot have four husbands. I don't know which woman would want four husbands, but there's definitely not equality there. No. All the guy has to do to divorce his wife is say, I divorce you three times. And she's out the door. She can't even go back in and get her clothes. It's over. And so it is, it doesn't have a tradition of standing up for rights of women. That's for sure.
Well, Bill, can you hang on and stay with us through the break and continue? Because we have also been fed a lot of garbage as to why the pilgrims actually came to America and what they started when they came here initially. According to what our kids are learning, these people came with slaves and made the slaves do all the work. And this was a whole thing that was created on slavery. So, Bill, I'm going to ask you if you can stay with us and straighten that one out. And
sure.
We will be right back. This is Karen Schoen. You're listening to The Prism of America. Education brought to you on the America Out Loud Radio Network with my wonderful sponsor, the Florida Citizens Alliance, and my wonderful guest, Bill Federer. Go to his website, AmericanMinute.com, and sign up and get his newsletter. Hang on, folks. We will be right back.
Dr. Peter McCullough, if you go to HealthyCell.com, you can check out the technology, the products of HealthyCell. These are very innovative products. They are a form of bio-nutraceuticals that are bioactive, and they come in a variety of categories. One is daily essentials, which are the bioactive multi and the vegan essentials. And then the next category is performance, and this is the REM sleep supplement. I've talked about it a lot. I think it's very effective, and I recommend it for myself and for my family, but as well as my patients. I'm having great luck with this because it is such a terrific product with a blend of, I think, is what's needed for not only promoting sleep, but also getting quality sleep. And when gets quality sleep, then there's restfulness, and the next day is better, and then the next night is better, and it becomes a progressively positive cycle for the human body. And the next product in the performance category is Focus and Recall. Focus and Recall. And I think that is the featured product that is coming into play for those with long COVID and brain fog that develops after COVID-19, the respiratory infection, but also after COVID-19 vaccination. And then finally, the main horse in HealthyCell is the targeted support of Immune Super Boost. And what we have here is a series of products that really can toe the line for patients who are working their way through the COVID-19 pandemic, either at risk for COVID-19, have had COVID-19 and recovered, are in the post-COVID syndrome, which is now a diagnosis we put in the electronic medical record, and are suffering through a variety of manifestations of post-COVID syndrome. And then lastly, those who are in the throes of vaccine reactions of some sort, whether they be acute serious vaccine reactions or the more common mild prolonged vaccine reactions. We now know the spike protein lasts in the human body after the respiratory infection or after vaccination for up to 15 months. We had this breaking development brought to you on America Out Loud Talk Radio with Dr. Bruce Patterson on a recent episode. So we know this is the case. And so we know if the Wuhan spike protein is in the human body for up to 15 months, it's going to cause damage. It's going to cause inflammation. It's going to set a whole variety of immune responses up, working against our body and potentially damaging cells, tissues, intercellular communication systems, and very importantly, influencing organ function. And here is where we need the maximum defense for the body, the maximum and the most appropriate blend of micronutrients, minerals, as well as vitamins to help the body get through this difficult time. So go to HealthyCell.com and check out the products. And in the promotional code, use the term OUTLOUD for 20% off your first purchase. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Karen Schoen. You're listening to the Prism of America's Education, brought to you on the America Out Loud Talk Radio Network with my wonderful sponsor, the Florida Citizens Alliance. Please go to goflca.com, sign up for the Alliance, and become part of the fight. If we don't participate, there isn't going to be any fight, and there isn't going to be any country. And that is absolutely up to we, the people. The more they try to put us down, the more we have to get up and fight. Bill, tell us about the pilgrims, because our children are being taught that these slave owners came over to America with the express desire to have slaves. That's absolutely wrong.
Yeah, so it's a deconstruction, and it is a tactic used in, you know, brainwashing and taking over countries and the pilgrims. So they were in Europe, in England, and the king of England was Henry VIII, and he originally was Catholic, and he was married to the daughter of Catherine of Aragon. And after 18 years, she did not have a son. Henry decides to divorce her. The Pope won't recognize the divorce. So Henry decides to make himself his own Pope. He starts the Church of England, puts himself on as the head, goes on to have six wives. and their fates were divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. So Henry VIII was not a really nice guy to be married to.
No.
His advisor suggested if he's serious about breaking from Rome, he needs to stop using that Latin Bible. Get himself an English Bible. The German princes have Martin Luther's German Bible. That helped them to break away. He needs an English Bible. Just so happens a few years earlier, Henry VIII had William Tyndale burnt at the stake for translating the Bible into English. William Tyndale's last words were, "Lord, open the King of England's eyes." Now the king wants an English Bible, so they take Tyndale's work, polish it up, they call it the Great Bible, and Henry VIII orders a copy of it put in every church in England. He dusts his hands, he says, "That's it, we've broken from Rome." But something unexpected happened. People began to read it, began to compare what's in this Bible to this king divorcing and beheading his wives, and so a group starts to purify the Church of England. They're nicknamed Puritans. There's another group that said, "It's beyond hope of purifying, we're going to separate ourselves." And they would meet in secret barns and basements by candlelight, and we call them pilgrims. And so some of these pilgrim separatists sell their property, and they arrange for a Dutch ship to take them to Holland, because there was some tolerance in the Dutch area there. Right before the ship leaves, the captain robs them, turns them over to the police. They're put in jail because they're heretics. They're not believing the way the king said. Another group of these pilgrim separatists sell their property. They arrange for a Dutch ship to sail along the coast, and they would be waiting in rowboats and hurry up and row out. The pilgrims showed up a day early, and the boat's rocking in the waves, and the women and children are getting sick, and so they put them on the shore while the men wait, and then the boat comes. The men row out. They're stowing everything on the boat. When someone snitched, the British come over the hill. The Dutch captain pulls anchor and sails away with the pilgrim men. And you can imagine these women on shore watching that boat getting smaller and smaller until it disappears over the horizon. For 2 years, they pass these women and children from one court and prison and jail in England to another. Finally, a judge says, "You really didn't do anything wrong. Go home." And these women are like, "Duh, we sold our homes." Well, just to get them out of their hair, they put them on a boat, sent them over to Holland. They were able to find out where their husbands were and reunited, went to Amsterdam, and then went to Leiden, Holland, and they're there for 12 years. Spain threatens to attack. They decide to flee again, and they were going to go to Guyana, South America, but they heard about it being too close to Spain. So the Spanish Main is the Caribbean, and 1565, a bunch of French Protestants tried to settle Florida. In Jacksonville, they called it Fort Caroline. And the Spanish found out about it and butchered all the men and then took the women and children away. And so these pilgrims said, "No, we don't want to go to, you know, anywhere near Spain, because even though it has a perpetual spring and it's nice tropical weather, we might get killed." So they decided to go to Jamestown. They leave England. One of their boats is called the Speedwell, but it does not speed well. It begins to leak. They take it back, try to fix it, leaks again. They have to consolidate, put everything on the Mayflower. They take off, and it's a 66-day journey. They are caught in the North Atlantic storms. They go 3,000 miles. They finally get to the shores of America in late November, and they're 500 miles away from Jamestown. And they try going down the coast, but off Cape Cod, it's really shallow, and they almost sink. And the captain says, "It's too dangerous to sail." It goes back to Plymouth Rock and says, "Everyone off the boat." And they say, "We have a question. Who's going to be in charge of us? We were going to go to Jamestown, submit to the king's government, and there's no king-appointed person on our boat. Who's going to be in charge?" They do something unique. They give themselves the authority to start a government. It's called the Mayflower Compact. And it says, "We, in the presence of God, covenant ourselves together to form a civil body politic, to enact just and equal laws, it shall be thought most necessary, unto which we promise all due submission." Simple, revolutionary. It was a polarity change in the flow of power. Instead of top-down rule by kings and pharaohs and sultans and kaisers and maharajas and czars, it's ruled bottom-up by we. And we're going to make the laws, and we're going to submit to the laws. Where did they get this idea? From their pastor, John Robinson. He was not a king-appointed Anglican pastor. He was a Congregationalist pastor, one of these, you know, Protestant New Testament style of a church government where everybody in the congregation is supposed to be involved in the ministry. The pastor's job is to teach each person to have their own relationship with God and then coach them to grow up in spiritual maturity so they can go out and replicate. And everybody's supposed to be involved. And the King of England didn't like that model. He liked the model where he was the head. And he had his Archbishop of Canterbury and Archbishop of York and all these, you know, deaneries and vicars and curates. And he was in charge. And but these pilgrims with this, their pastor, John Robinson, it's this church model. Everybody's involved. These pilgrims simply took their church model of government and they made it their community model of government. And that became the model for the other New England colonies. It's called town hall meetings. And they had the same building. So they called their church a meeting house. The word synagogue is Hebrew. It means meeting house. And so in every little Hebrew village, they would have the Levi teach them the law, but that's also where they would elect their elders. And so these town hall meetings became the norm for New England. When the revolution started, the British had their military governor come over, Thomas Gage, and he outlawed town hall meetings. He said, democracy is too prevalent in America. So we don't need people meeting and passing resolutions. You just do what the king tells you to do. You just surrender your conscience to the king and you do what the king tells you to do. You believe what the king tells you to believe. You're just owned by the government. If the government tells you that there's no more male and female, or the government tells you to kill babies, you just have to do whatever the government says. If the government says it has to inject something in your body, you got to surrender your body to the government, right? The pilgrims didn't like that model. And so they set up that we're in charge and we all will agree and then we'll submit to what we agree upon. So that's why we look to the pilgrims as this model of self-government. In the womb of this little Mayflower is this polarity change in the flow of power. Instead of top down, it's bottom up.
And that's why it is hated so much. And that is why we are being told lies about the pilgrims. They came here. Bill, you're the one that explained they came here and they studied and participated and practiced a form of socialism, which they discovered didn't work.
The pilgrims, by the way, they had self-government, but they still had to pay back debts to the investors that paid for their boat ride. And so they had their representatives that, signed the paperwork that said, okay, they'll pay for the boat ride. You can come to the New World, but they expected to get paid back. And so it was called a company. And the company that these investors had formed had bylaws. And the bylaws said everything was owned in common. Everything gained by cooking, hunting, fishing, trading shall go into ye common stock. And everyone's livelihood shall come out of ye common stock. And they tried it and they almost starved to death. And William Bradford, the governor of the pilgrims, said that the young man objected to being forced to spend their time in working for other men's wives and children without any recompense. The strong man or the resourceful man had no more share of food, clothes, etc. than the weak man. This was considered an injustice. The graver, aged and graver men who were ranked and equalized in labor with the younger and humbler ones considered it an indignity and disrespect. As for men's wives, who were obliged to do service for other men, such as cooking, washing their clothes, etc., they considered it a kind of slavery, and many husbands would not brook it or allow it. William Bradford says, let none argue that this is due to human failing rather than to this communistic plan of life in itself. Calls it communistic. He says, God had a better plan. He says, so they began to consider how to raise more corn. And after much discussion, it was decided that every man would plant corn for his own household. This made all hands more industrious. Even the women now went willingly into the field and took their little ones with them to plant corn. While before, they would allege weakness and inability, and to compel them would have been thought great oppression. So they switched from an involuntary to a voluntary. That you're caring for your neighbors, not because the bylaws say so, and the bylaws authorizes the government to take weigh your stuff and redistribute it. No, you get your own land. You work hard, you produce stuff, but then you can be moved upon in your heart to voluntarily give away some of the stuff that is called charity. Okay. So it's a switch. People say, well, wasn't the early church communistic or socialistic? No, the early church was the early church. Socialism is counterfeit early church. And the difference is between the word voluntary and involuntary. So the early believers voluntarily sold their land. Nobody told them to. And they laid the money at the feet of Pilate. They didn't have their land taken away, and they were forced to put it at the feet of Pilate for the Roman government to redistribute. And voluntary versus involuntary is sort of a big deal with God. It's sort of like the whole reason he made us, right? He could have forced Adam and Eve not to eat from the tree in the garden, but he could have made us all instinctive, like dogs. We just follow instinct. No, he's given us a will, and we get to be use our voluntary will to decide to submit to God or not. And so the Old Testament, they went into the promised land, and every family was given land permanently. If you own land, you can accumulate stuff. The Bible called that being blessed. And if you have stuff, you can be moved upon to give away some of your stuff. The Bible called that charity. If you don't own anything, how can you be charitable? What are you going to steal from somebody and give it away? Now you're a thief and you've broken the law? No, God entrusts you with stuff. And then you have an opportunity to manifest in the physical world, which spiritually is in your heart.
Bill, what right now with this great reset that they are trying to force upon the American people and the rest of the Western world, I constantly go back to what Klaus Schwab said, which was, you will own nothing and be happy. So they are actually trying to take us back to when we own nothing and we're just beholden to the government because we can own nothing. Whereas ownership, as you said, can create equity, can create wealth, can create whatever it is that you, the individual, wants to create. So this whole idea, this whole concept of Great Reset is actually to go back to couple of hundred years ago where the kings were supreme and the people were the beggars. We're going back there, aren't we, Bill?
Yeah. And if anybody believes Klaus Schwab, they're naive. Machiavelli said effectively that if people are naive enough to believe the prince's lie, they'll be naive enough to believe the excuse of why the prince didn't do what he promised he would do. He said, this is Machiavelli. He says, the prince never lacks justification to break his promises. A promise made was a necessity of the past. A promise broken is a necessity of the present. It's double pleasure to deceive the deceiver. Only naive people believe the government when you have 6,000 years worth of track record of, I use the concept. All right. Socialism, everybody owns everything equally. Sounds nice, but let's think about how it actually is carried out. There has to be some government person that does the redistributing of stuff. And they're tempted to want to slip a little bit extra to their family and friends, and maybe hold back a little from the person that they don't like. And before you know it, it gets discretionary. And there's a saying, he who holds the purse strings has the power. Exactly. And so people say, well, so socialism is great. Everybody's equal. It's like a question. Who decides who lives in the dumpy house and who lives in the really nice house? Somebody in the government dictates those things. Well, whoever ultimately dictates those things is the dictator. So every experiment of people owning things in common always ends up in a dictatorship with a deep state ruling class that they decide to give themselves all the nice houses and they funnel a little bit extra to their family and friends. Who's going to hold them accountable, right? They're the ones in charge of divvying stuff out. And they want to take away the money from those that they don't like. And so there's nobody left to challenge their power. And it always ends up in a dictatorship. Even if it starts off with really good people, I use a biblical analogy. Here's Joseph in Egypt. He's a godly guy. He helps concentrate power into the hands of the Pharaoh. And what did that particular Pharaoh do with the concentrated power? He fed the children of Israel, gave them the best land at Goshen, gave them jobs taking care of his cattle. But then there was a new Pharaoh that did not know Joseph. And he used all that concentrated power to oppress the children of Israel, make them slaves, and even throw their sons in the Nile River. So that's the dilemma. Let's say that you actually start off with good people wanting to do good things, but they're not alive forever. And at some point, it gets into the hands of somebody that's not really good at doing things, and they like their job, and they don't want to be thrown out, and they begin to use their power in a discretionary way, and they end up becoming oppressive. So that's why at the Tower of Babel, God scattered the power. He says, anybody can be tempted to want to prefer their family and friends. So let's just scatter the power. Let's not let it get concentrated. And so the idea is you take the power of the king, you put it into the hands of the people, you break it into three branches, you separate it federal to state level, you tie it up with 10 handcuffs, we call the first 10 amendments. All our Constitution and Bill of Rights are a bunch of hurdles to prevent the rubber band from snapping back into the hands of a king. But I wrote a book called Socialism, The Real History from Plato to the Present. There are two methods in which the king can take the power back. One is fear. If the people get in fear, in a fearful situation, they'll panic, knee-jerk reaction. They'll surrender their freedoms to somebody promising to fix the mess. And the second is free stuff. And you can, people get dependent, and then they incrementally will surrender more of their independence in order to continue getting the free stuff. And
one thing I can say about getting the free stuff, folks, it's never of the highest quality. When you get the free stuff, it's always at the low end. Think about it. They're not going to give you the best of the best and hurt their own bottom line. So they have to give you the worst of the worst so that their profitability is higher. That's what this is always about. It's always about money, power, and control. And from what Bill has described today, there is no difference between what happened hundreds of years ago and what's going on today in America. It's the same concept. It's the same idea, the same people thinking the same ideology. We're better than you. We should have the power. And the heck with you, you should work for us. And that's basically what socialism, communism is all about. Concentrating the power in the hands of the few to subdue the many. And we see that over and over again. So nothing is more important, Bill, than what we're going to be facing with this election in 2022. So what do you think people should be asking their new candidates that they go to a town hall meeting? Now we know where that came from, to a town hall meeting and hear what new candidates have to say. What do you think they should be asking, Bill?
First is how to stop voter fraud. I ran for Congress three times, and we personally experienced my name being left off the ballot in five wards in the city of St. Louis. And when we brought it to their attention on election day, they're like, oh, we'll fix it next time around. It's like, okay. And then we had the our volunteer at one of the boards of election, and they were checking off all the precincts, and they said, we can't find the box of ballots from Guffey Elementary School. And it's like, I stood in front of Guffey Elementary School for 8 hours today, and you're telling me they lost the box of ballots from that? And then we had people whose parents were in nursing homes and had Alzheimer's, and they found out that their parents had voted. And they go, my parents don't even recognize me anymore. How did they know who to vote for? And they said, oh, well, they had somebody come in and help them. I mean, there are so many different ways to do voter fraud that unless we can be confident of an honest election, then all of our, we're blowing in the wind. I mean, it's all an act of futility. You go out and you campaign real. I mean, for 2 years, we'd go out, we'd raise money, we'd speak at speeches, we'd go people. And then on election night, they would have some emergency that would, we had computers where I was ahead at the Jefferson County Board of Election, and then all the electricity goes off in the entire building. And when they reboot everything, the computers go from showing us ahead to now we're behind. It's like, what happened? And then we did some research and we found out that they have all kinds of different programs that that they, you know, the some are date sensitive where it'll count perfectly the day before, day after the election, but on that particular date of the election, it'll sort everything out to a predetermined percentage. And with all these lines of code, and then there's modems that are made in other countries that they can have a trap door where they can get in and adjust the election results. I mean, there's so many different ways to do the voter fraud. Yep, really, the only secure way is to do paper ballots and count them at the precinct 100 times and make everybody sign off on them before you send them over to the headquarters, you know.
So, Bill, what parting words do you have to say to our audience? Because we are coming to the close of our show, and I love having you on because I always learn so much.
Well, thank you so much. My website is AmericanMinute.com. AmericanMinute.com, and the book that I have been talking about is, well, actually a couple of them, on the Pilgrims. It's called The Treacherous World of the 16th Century and How the Pilgrims Escaped It. The Treacherous World of the 16th Century and How the Pilgrims Escaped It. And then there's one on socialism, and it's entitled Socialism, the Real History from Plato to the Present. And it goes through all the dynamics of concentrating power and so forth. But AmericanMinute.com.
AmericanMinute.com is absolutely wonderful. You will get a surprise email every single day of something in American history, and it is exactly what we need to be sharing. We're going to be coming up on Christmas, and the socialism book that Bill wrote is something that everyone should have. You need to be able to reference. You need to be able to understand. Most important, you have to understand they are lying to you. And they will never, ever stop lying because it is part of what they believe. They believe the ends justify the means, and they don't care how they go about getting it. And that's really what we have to be looking out for the most. So, Bill, I'm going to ask you to come back and share with us another segment of history. And hopefully you'll be able to do that. And I want to thank you so much for joining me today. It has been a pleasure as always.
Well, thank you. And it's an honor to be with you, and blessings to all the listeners.
Thank you. And have a wonderful holiday season, everyone. And we will see you again next week. This is Karen Schoen. You're listening to The Prism of America's Education. And we are brought to you on the America Out Loud Talk Radio Network.com. And please, my wonderful sponsor, please go and see what the Florida Citizens Alliance is up to as we are writing legislation. We are helping the legislators come up with the verbiage that is necessary to get bills passed in a meaningful manner that actually have teeth and consequences, because telling someone to do something and not holding them accountable is how we got into the trouble we are in right now. We have not been holding our legislators accountable. So as we are going to be facing this new election season, please make sure that you are dedicated to holding your legislators accountable. They can't represent you if you don't talk to them. They can't represent you if they don't understand where you're coming from and why. And they certainly won't represent you if you elect the wrong people. So please pay attention, folks. Have a wonderful week, and I will see you again next time. Thank you. But I'll always stand proud and free. I'm America. Don't tread on me. I'm America. Yes, America.